This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Democrats try to hog all the public space in Philadelphia, shutting out the protesters. A political prisoner wins a long legal battle against solitary confinement. And if you think criminal law is stacked against the poor, civil law is in some ways even worse. But first, something is different in Black America than it was 2 weeks ago. The police killings of Black men in Baton Rouge and Minneapolis, the massive protests that followed, and Micah Johnson's retaliation against Dallas police left a distinct mark on the Black psyche. We asked Dr. Anthony Montero, the Du Boisian scholar and member of the Black Radical Organizing Committee, if he thinks something has changed in the mood and the minds of Black folks.
I certainly did, and I think everybody that pays attention at all could sense that we're approaching a new moment, a new spirit of the time. The murders of Philando Castile and the brother in Baton Rouge, plus the actions of the young man who took justice into his own hands and killed five Dallas policemen, all of this manifested the new struggle, the new crisis that has to do with Black oppression. And what we see in these continuing demonstrations all over the country, no major city or medium-sized city or even a small town is without some form of demonstration, often civil disobedience, shutting down freeways and major highways, tens of thousands of people marching, hundreds of people arrested. Indeed, we are at a new moment in the history of the nation and in the history of the struggle for Black freedom.
The New York Times and other corporate media outlets seem to be demanding that Blacks stand down in the wake of the killings of the Dallas police. And it looked like the Congressional Black Caucus was saying the same thing as they tried to change the subject to gun control. But folks didn't stand down.
No. And that's very, very significant. And in fact, what we have seen over the last 2 years is an evolution of a movement into a more united, a more ideologically clear, programmatically focused movement. It's not yet completely there, of course, but this is what we're looking at. It's not backing up. People are in the streets. They're not going to return to their homes. The ruling elites now know there is a political price to be paid for the murders of young Black men and women. And I think this has unbelievable impact. I think we're at a moment of truth in the history of this country. I think on the other side, with the weakness of the candidates of the two major parties, Clinton and Trump, that we might be approaching a moment where the country becomes ungovernable by the political class that is tied to Wall Street and the 1%.
It also appears that it's rather difficult to get average Black people to give a blanket denunciation of Micah Johnson's actions in Dallas.
Very significant. And you know, Glenn, when you put it all together, when you try to look at the picture in its totality, you know, Black people still profess allegiance and admiration and love for Barack Obama. But at the same time, they will not denounce the young man in Dallas who carried out what may have been a desperate act, let us say, but they will not denounce him, almost believing that it was an act of justice. And, you know, since most black people are Christians and part of Christianity is the Old Testament, and the Old Testament upholds an eye for an eye. And so you get this clash or collision of sentiments within the black community and probably within the minds of millions of black people. We support black lives. We support even an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But then they also say they uphold Obama, who is in opposition to the very thing that they support in terms of the movement.
And Obama, of course, says that we're not returning to a period like that of the 60s. And of course, no period exactly replicates another, but there are similarities that could be pointed out.
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, and the first thing we have to say, how would Obama know? He has never participated in any movement, let alone the movements of the 60s. And so to be accurate about the parallels or the similarities, you literally have to talk to people who were there and a part of those movements. And I would say that there are real parallels and real similarities, with the exception that this movement and this moment might go beyond what the 60s were. It's almost as though we're starting up from the 1980s and going forward from the militancy of the 1970s. We're now, rather than civil rights, the whole problem of human rights and self-determination and liberation is what you're hearing on the streets these days.
And yet at this moment, we have the two candidates or presumptive candidates of the duopoly political system, both of them extremely unpopular with the American public at large.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, this is extraordinary. It reflects the legitimation crisis of the ruling elite, the political class, the political structures linked to the one percenters. This is huge. But the most dramatic thing happening in terms of public attitudes is that 67%, according to the New York Times CBS poll this week, 67% of voters do not trust Hillary Clinton. Only 28% of them trust her. And this is a decline in her trustworthiness from the month before, from June. She declined 5%. So she's losing ground. And I think it will continue. They could spend $10 billion on advertisement. I don't think they will ever be able to convince the American voters, including black voters, that Hillary Clinton is trustworthy and is anything other than a person who breaks the law. But because she is a part of the elite and because of their connections, she can get away with it. And people don't like that. You know, Glenn, I think that the Democrats are going to have to decide when they come here to Philadelphia whether they stick with her as their candidate, because I think she cannot win against Trump. Or if she wins, it will be by such a narrow margin that it will leave most people thinking that perhaps they stole it.
In other words, neither of the parties, the duopoly parties' candidates, can give a mandate to the rule of the duopolies.
No, they can't. They can't. You know, when you look at the numbers right now, in terms of polls nationally, Clinton and Trump are tied, running exactly even, 40% each. But 20% are undecided or won't vote for either of them. That's huge. And even among those who say they're going to vote for one of them, there is still a sense that neither is really capable of addressing the real problems confronting the country at this time. But Hillary Clinton, the chosen consensus candidate of the 1%, of the Wall Streeters, is the most disliked, the most distrusted candidate probably in the history of American politics. This is huge. I don't know how they go forward with her. And if they do go forward with her and she wins, I don't know how they govern with her. It's a crisis at a level that we have never experienced, except right before the Civil War.
What do you mean by crisis of legitimacy? Legitimacy in terms of a candidate or a personality is one thing, Trump's legitimacy, Hillary Clinton's perceived legitimacy by the public. But a crisis of legitimacy in society means more than Trump and Hillary.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm using it in the way that political scientists have used it over the years. And when they talk about a crisis of legitimacy, they mean, in effect, that the people do not trust their government. The people do not see the government as their government and reject it. And in many ways saying they are unhappy with the way they're being governed, and in other ways say they refuse to be governed in the ways that they have been governed. Usually a prolonged crisis of legitimacy leads to political and social breakdown and could anticipate the rise of a new system of the political organization of society and could lead to new leadership. It could also, in a transitionary moment, be manifested in the mobilization and organization of people to govern themselves in their local areas. Let me give you one example. The police. Across the country, people are calling for community control of police, and in some instances are talking about communities policing themselves. This is a form of not just community control, but alternative political power. You could take the same thing, for example, with education, with the collapse of public education and the charterization of public education. People are saying the right to self-determination and the right to sovereignty over education means that they have to take things into their own hands. Another example, the formation throughout the country of what back in the days we used to call survival programs, community gardens, consumer cooperatives, different types of economic activity to provide the needs of the people. These all represent alternative centers of power in a moment when the traditional government and political system is seen as illegitimate.
You seem to be saying that these kinds of alternative politics in the black community that up until recently had been rendered marginal are no longer so. They are really part of the plausible and discussable mix.
Yes, I think so, Glenn. I really think so. And, you know, as we discussed before, it's often very difficult for traditional polling methodologies to get at the real sentiment of what black people feel, what Du Bois called the souls of black folk. On the one side, black people don't like to tell people on the phone and people representing polling institutions what they really think because of the legitimate distrust of the racial other of the mainstream institutions and so on. On the other side, you know, black people are often of two and three different minds about things. But I think that within this new moment, what we are going to see among black folk is an attempt to build institutions of self-determination, which represent black power and people's power, and that emerge from the grassroots. And they will be linked both to institutions of survival and caring for communities and to movements of protest. And I think the movements of protest and the movements of survival, institutions of survival and governance at the grassroots level will feed upon each other. It creates a situation of radical social change from the bottom up.
In the more immediate sense, how do you think this might be manifested in Philadelphia?
You mean at the convention?
Yes.
I think that black folk will probably be a significant part of the protests and demonstrations. Black Philadelphia will be a part of various activities that will be going on throughout the city during the time of the Democratic Party convention. That includes forums and conferences and marches and civil disobedience and other things. I think what we will see are significant movement towards the grassroots, the working class, the lower middle class, the poor, the unemployed, asserting their power, their self-determination against the black misleadership class. And, you know, just looking at things from here, I can tell you the black misleadership class, the political class, that group most linked to corporate and financial power here in this city are very worried about what all of this means in terms of their leadership of black folk.
There is no group in the United States that is more wedded to an institutional political party than blacks are to Democrats. But do you think even that kind of relationship is now frayed, if not collapsing?
I think it is. I think it's frayed and collapsing. Black folks are not unaware of the fact that the Congressional Black Caucus has had very little significant to say about the 2 years of marches and demonstrations and murders of black young people in the street. Had very little to say. The black community is not blind to the fact that very few church leaders and churches have joined the protest. And that the whole structure of tying us to the Obama administration and now to the Clinton campaign is seen as a form of bad faith, dishonesty, and disingenuousness by the black masses. In other words, people are aware of the fact that the misleadership class is more interested in their well-being as a class as opposed to the well-being of the community as a whole. And this is going to wreak havoc upon the black misleadership class in the very near future.
Genuine leadership is, of course, born in struggle. Do you see
Absolutely.
A new leadership emerging?
I do. I see it very clearly among the millennials. That goes without saying. There'll be new leaders emerging within the churches. There'll be new leaders emerging from the rank and file of black labor. There will be new leaders emerging in the student movement. And they will be as young as 10 and 12 and 15 years old. We are on the cusp of the formation of a new leadership, a new movement, a new coalition, a new united front that portends well for the future. Now, it won't be easy. This will be a difficult process because it will occur under conditions of terrorism, of repression, and of intensified white supremacy. This will be also sharpened because of the economic conditions getting worse for black people and all working people, by the way. So I think these processes towards the formation of the new, towards the birth of the new, will occur under circumstances where what is old will fight tooth and nail to hold on to what they have against this emerging new leadership, emerging new institutions, emerging new consciousness and movement.
And we also see new models of behavior personified last week by Diamond Reynolds, the young black woman who communicated to the world right after her boyfriend was shot right next to her in greater Minneapolis.
That was unbelievable. And of course, her four-year-old daughter, who was sitting in the back seat, who comforted her mother by saying to her that, "Mom, he's gone." That was something that they're not words to describe. One wonders where such superhuman courage comes from. She committed herself, and she could have been killed. to getting that narrative out, to showing to the world, very much in the way that Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, said, "I want the world to see what they did to my son." That young woman was saying, in effect, "I want the world to see what they've done."
And the response on Friday was cities across the country seeing renewed and more militant demonstrations.
Absolutely. In Minneapolis, in St. Paul, in Atlanta, in Philadelphia, in Chicago, this is a national uprising. And it won't be ended. It will not be terrorized. And it is animating the nation. It is raising not just the consciousness of police brutality and racism, but it is creating a new moral context for behavior, where people's moral character is decided by what they do in practice. What side are you on in this great battle for justice?
Dr. Anthony Montero of the Black Radical Organizing Committee, speaking from Philadelphia. Thousands are expected to descend on Philadelphia next week for protests at the Democratic National Convention. Scott Williams of the International Action Center is an organizer for a Shut Down the DNC march on July 26th. However, before the protesters can confront the National Democratic Party, they first have to fight with the local Democrats and the police.
Well, Glenn, as you know, Philadelphia essentially is a one-party dictatorship. The Democratic Party runs nearly every aspect of life here, and we have a long history with the Philadelphia police, who are known as being one of the most racist, one of the most anti-protesting and anti-First Amendment police forces in the history of the United States. Whether you look back at the Black Panther Party and their Revolutionary People's Convention, or if you think about MOVE, or even our history more recently in Occupy and Black Lives Matter, the Philadelphia police have gone out of their way to brutalize and harass protesters and leaders of movements, especially people of color, and that is their history and role. And that's no different here with the Democratic National Convention. We see we're in the midst of a Black Lives Matter uprising, in a sense, right now, in the last week and a half, where we've had many demonstrations bringing out thousands of people. There's even one right, this afternoon. And we think that kind of momentum will kind of carry us into the Democratic National Convention. You look at a city like Philadelphia, it's, 45% Black. A huge population of Latino and Puerto Rican people and a lot of other people of color. And it's incredible intense poverty and racism and white supremacy that kind of thoroughly exudes the entire history of the city. We think it makes perfect sense that the Democratic Party is having the convention here because of what they represent, which is nothing other than this kind of history of white supremacy and capitalism.
So you're not only going to make demands upon the Democratic Party, but first you are making demands upon the city and the Department of Homeland Security in terms of the conditions that will exist when you're making those demands on the Democrats.
Exactly. Of course, formally, the city controls the whole permit process, and they attempted to create all sorts of phony restrictions. Like originally limiting protesters during rush hour, which is effectively limiting almost every protest you can have. The Democratic Party has taken over every public space, and they have a permit for every major public space in the Center City area for the entire convention, meaning you can't have a rally unless you meet right in the middle of the street. And so we promised the city of Philadelphia that we are going to rally in the middle of the street right at City Hall. We don't care about a permit. We don't care about anything they say. We're going to take what we want. And in organizing this, we've had a long back and forth. Different organizations have sued the city. And the city, in some ways, is starting to back down because they don't want for hundreds or even thousands of people to be arrested when Hillary is being anointed as the next possible president of the United States. They don't want to see hundreds and thousands of Black people and Black protesters, getting arrested at the Democratic Party National Convention, which is supposed to represent Black people. We know it doesn't. But they've started with heavy restrictions. it seems like they're kind of giving in. They started by saying that what they're going to do is open up Holmesburg Prison and plan to mass arrest us, as they did in the 2000 Republican National Convention when it was in Philadelphia. But they've since backed down. And this comes on the heel of a lot of successful demonstrations over the past years, especially with the Philadelphia Coalition for Real Justice, where the police have consistently arrested and harassed the leaders of demonstrations. And then when it's gone to court, we've been found not guilty in every single case. That's over 40 cases where we're found not guilty of all of a whole variety of charges, and every time the police have lost in court. We have a coalition of activists and progressive lawyers that work really together in a way, and I think they're actually in some ways pushed back by our success more recently in fighting against all of their harassment and arrest of leading protesters.
Now, when you say that the Democrats have monopolized all the public space downtown Philadelphia, are you speaking of the Democratic National Committee Democrats or the Sanders Democrats, or do the Sanders Democrats exist at all anymore?
That's a great question. But right now, the Democratic National Committee has permits for the major area right at City Hall, which is called Dilworth Park, which is where the Occupy movement was, which is where police officer Darren Wilson was found not guilty for the murder of Mike Brown. Everyone met at City Hall, and they know that's the place where everyone goes to for a major demonstration. The Democratic National Committee has that for an entire week. You know, you won't even touch it, and it's the most major central public space in the city. There are other major parks right there that are all reserved. And so we've been consistently denied permits based on the fact that there is no public space, which we find to be completely outrageous. And that's why we'll be assembling in the street.
Do you expect to have lots of Bernie Sanders supporters or former supporters in the lines of march?
You know, as Sanders endorsed Clinton earlier this week, you know, there's a major question mark. Who amongst the Sanders people are really feeling rebellious and revolutionary in a way? And we're not sure. We've heard of a lot of different organizers who we don't know at all, even though we've been in the movement here in Philadelphia for decades. We've heard of a lot of Sanders people saying that they're going to be demonstrating. But at this point, it's very unclear that there will be thousands of Sanders supporters like originally expected. Originally, we heard that Sanders himself was going to lead the march on Sunday before the Democratic National Convention. That is no longer true. You know, I think we're seeing, of course, Sanders is bringing everyone back into the Democratic Party. And I'm sure there'll be other people, you know, challenging that.
Have you noted any change in the police attitude towards these demonstrations in Philadelphia since the events in Dallas?
The day after of Dallas, the next 2 days, we had major demonstrations in the community, marching in the predominantly Black and Puerto Rican neighborhoods of North Philadelphia. You know, we had several hundred people marching directly up. Our goal was to shut down these two police headquarters in the community. And we marched up right to their front door, and we were met by literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of officers. Oftentimes in Philadelphia, the police are there to completely intimidate demonstrators with a massive show of force. You see these guys that look like they're ready for war, like pictures out of Ferguson, pictures out of, you know, Israel. You know, we see this huge amount of intimidation, but we have not seen, at least right after Dallas, any major arrests or attacks on demonstrators. But on the flip side, we have seen quite a number of pro-cop rallies in the white working class, which seem to be complete fabrications and just publicity stunts. But certainly, Philadelphia police have a long racist history, and they're very frustrated. No matter what happened in Dallas, you know, we were not going anywhere. We're not going to slow down for that. So things are moving forward.
That was Scott Williams of the International Action Center in Philadelphia. Angelo Brown, a Black father of 15 children, who was shot to death by police in Belleville, Illinois, near St. Louis, was also known as Hudari Julani, a general in the revolutionary Black Panther Party. The police claimed that Angelo Brown threatened them with a gun. His body showed signs of having been beaten. Dr. Ali Mohammed is chief general in command of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party. He's also a doctor of neurological medicine. Dr. Muhammad talks about his slain comrade.
General Hudari Jilani, also known as Angelo Brown, with us he's known as General Hudari Jilani. He is the National Minister of Defense, HQ, in the Revolutionary Black Panther Party, which is a national leader. And he also was the local leader in Belleville and in St. Louis. Now, for a couple weeks, he was harassed by local law enforcement in both places, St. Louis and in Belleville. One time in Belleville, while he was out doing the food program, they were out there, threw some food over, hurled threats and epithets at him. And well, we concluded that it was just typical harassment against Panthers. We take all threats serious, and we did give instructions that he not be alone while he was out there, but we just concluded that it was just typical. We had no idea that they were going to take it as far as, you know, as they took it. So basically on that Thursday, he was out there doing the program. You know, that's the days that he did the food program there in Belleville. And I had talked to him about 40 minutes prior to that incident happening. Everything was fine. You know, he was jovial, energetic, and ready. And that's what he was doing in that area. And we had no idea that the weeks leading up to this, as far as the constant harassment, it was every time he was out, he was harassed, both places harassed consistently for the weeks leading up to it. And so when this information came to us that he was murdered, when we first got the information, it was via a family member, his family member. And we had to verify that it was true because we had, you know, this is, we're talking about a difference of a day. I just spoke to him. And it really didn't add up and make too much sense. And then when we got the total information, what they did is they contacted his mother, and it was very, very rude, their manner of communicating with her. See, my history of helping out families who are victims of police murder or been either shot or beaten to death by the police, in the history of me working with families, I've always seen this pattern they have. And this pattern is that once they do that, they don't allow the family to identify the body at all. They rush the body to a funeral home so the mortician, in my total assumption, can just do some cosmetic work. So they called the mother and was like, you know, we can't give you no information. We just need to know what funeral home to send his body to. So that's how they was talking to her. And she's distraught. I mean, you know, her son is gone, murdered. She'll never see him again, hear from him again, talk to him again. When she informed me about that, I immediately contacted the coroners that he was gone by then. So I contacted the funeral home and let them know at this time that I was going to be sending some investigators there and others who would be able to do some type of ballistic basically on his body to see if there was any, because they had claims in the paper that he fired shots at them and all these far out, just wild stories that just didn't really add up because it was two and three different stories. So what happened is that, you know, at that time, of course, you know, they washed the body. And so that interferes with being able to do any type of real forensics at that point for those people who will be doing that work. But then the funeral home started trying to give a problem because I needed the pictures to be taken and no cosmetic work. So the next day I noticed that, I'm not saying that they did that, but it's just another assumption because the papers report another story that, oh, he didn't shoot at us. He just wouldn't put his gun down. So that knocks the whole idea of seeing if he had any residue on his hand out the window. So they were giving us a hard time with taking pictures. We finally got them to agree to it through legal pressure. You know, we let them know that, you know, they were hired, you know, and what they had to do. And there's a document prepared for the family, and they signed it and delivered it. So they said, okay, fine, pictures can be taken, but we're not going to do it. So I hired a photographer and sent him down there, and he took the pictures. And it was devastating what the end result of that was. There was no defensive wound on his body, no ligature marks. He had one shot to his body, and it was to his head at the temple. Just one projectile shot, no shots any other place on his body. And his face was bruised badly, blackened eyes, some bruised lip and nose damage, and a big knot on his head. And one projectile wound to his head. Now, none of us was there, but there's only so many ways to take that type of shot. what would not be so obvious if somebody being in the bushes taking a shot like that with a rifle. That seems more like television, but it's possible. But the other way to take that shot is point blank, the way that the entry wound is and the exit wound is a little entry wound and a big exit wound. It's something that's either from a rifle or something on point blank. And we're inclined to believe that it was point blank, but we are ultimately certain that this was an assassination and murder. The first time a Black Panther leader has been murdered by full uniform police since the 1960s, 1970s. And so we immediately got on it. And they were doing all type of character assassination, lying. We thought he was drunk. He had a gun at the door. Then he ran from us, and we chased after him. He fired shots at us, and we fired back. First it was three officers, they said. Then they said it was two officers that fired shot at him, and the two officers shot. This is how they reported it. The two officers that fired shots at him, their shots killed him. But he doesn't have any wounds on his body except for one shot to his temple. And so even if you took that shot and somebody was running, I mean, were they running sideways? How do you make that shot? And I myself, besides my medical profession, neurologist, I'm also a certified firearm instructor, and I have previous combat experience. And even when it comes to just knowing trajectory, when it comes to just in essence, and any of us who in the South have ever been hunting, we know how things work in that context. There's a certain way that that certain wounds are going to be, unless it's like some magic bullet. So the point is that they murdered him and assassinated him straight to his head.
Most tellingly in terms of the police story is the fact, as is readily seen in those photographs, that he was beaten before death. Those marks are seen on his face.
Absolutely, that he was. They did beat him in his face. The more confusing aspect of that is he doesn't have defensive wounds. So to understand this, if we were to make an analytical assumption about that, after they shot him, they probably beat him in his face while he was dying because he doesn't have any defensive wounds. There's no marks on his arm, no bruises. His hands are clean. There's no bruises to his hand as if he was in an altercation. So they beat him. Yes, they did. They probably did that while he was dying, but they could have did it before.
What actions has the party taken since his death?
Currently what we're doing is we're actually filing human rights violations is what we're doing with International Criminal Court and the World Court for this being a crime against humanity, an act of genocide, intentional murder, and also we understand it to be a part of that 28-hour cycle of genocide against Black people where every 28 hours one of us is murdered by law enforcement in America. So this is where we're at in the party as far as actions is concerned. It's not exactly where we're just limited to, but this is where we're at right now in the process of getting justice and for those who are responsible paying for the crime that they actually did. What we also concluded on, a preliminary date was given for the weekend that just passed, but that was updated while we were in St. Louis during the burial, and we adjusted it to August. And the reason why this was done is because there were other activities to take place the weekend of August the 5th. And so our actual activities, August the 5th, it's a planned demonstration due to the fact that in the state of Missouri, you allowed open carry. We're going to have an armed human rights march. Our armed human rights march is called the Armed Anti-Genocide March against genocide against our people in his honor. And then Saturday the 6th, we were going to have the Human Rights Tribunal on Saturday, August the 6th, in St. Louis, Missouri.
How long had Houdari Gilani, also known as Angelo Brown, been a part of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party? And how long has the party been in existence?
He's been with us over a year. And we, by action, have been around since 1992. But I myself, you know, I grew up as a Panther Cub. And we see ourselves really as a continuation of the party from the 60s, except with some modern adjustments made based on the type of warfare and the type of struggle that we're dealing with as a people. But yes, we've been around for over 20 years.
And the Revolutionary Black Panther Party has nothing to do with the new Black Panther Party.
Yeah, nothing at all to do. We're not affiliated. We have no founding together. They actually were founded in 1989 by Aaron Michaels, also known as Aaron McCarthy. But we have no affiliation that way. They were founded then, and then, of course, you know, there was a split in the 90s that took place between Brother Aaron and Dr. Khalid, and so some people went one way and other people went the other way. But no, we're not affiliated in any way. But I will say this, as far as people who go under the name Panther, there is the Prisoners of Consciousness Coalition headed by Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. There is the Black Riders Liberation Party, New Generation of Panthers. There is the New Black Panther Party. Now, I'll explain that as far as Panthers are concerned, we have a mutual respect with the official New Black Panther Party, mutual respect and camaraderie, but in no way are we affiliated or part and parcel or one is an offshoot of the other or anything like that.
Is the Revolutionary Black Panther Party still operative in St. Louis after the death of its leader? And where else do you have chapters?
We have chapters throughout the country. We have chapters in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We have chapters in Newark, New Jersey. We have chapters in North and South Carolina. We have chapters in Jackson, Mississippi. And using the term general, to understand what that term is, okay, you have nationals and then you have local generals, because we are in the context, military, domestically speaking, militia, if you want to use that term. The term can be interchangeable, but the point is that the term general is the equivalent to a chairman or chairwoman or chairperson or chairman. So when you hear that term, to understand what that means, you have generals and you have sergeants and you have lieutenants, and then you have soldiers, of course, when you come in. But let me just get back to that. We have chapters in Maryland. We have chapters in Atlanta, Georgia. We have chapters in Los Angeles, California, Oklahoma, Texarkana, Arkansas. We have chapters in Florida and Texas. Pretty much we have a lot of chapters throughout the country. And we have a chapter in Trinidad, in the Caribbean, and in Tobago. And we have chapters international and national.
Dr. Ali Mohammed of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party. Mumia Abu-Jamal, a veteran of the original Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, is glad to report a victory for a fellow political prisoner.
Russell Maroon Schultz, after many years of hard struggle, has prevailed on his action to bar the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections from ever holding him in isolation again. In a remarkable settlement bringing an end to Schultz v. Wetzel, Maroon won on all counts. The only thing lacking is a judge's written opinion. Upon learning of the settlement, Maroon stated, "I have nothing but praise for all of those who supported me and my family for all the years I was in solitary confinement, as well as helped to effect my release. Since joining the struggle for human rights in the mid-1960s, I have always chosen to fight. Frederick Douglass was right when he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. So have no doubt that I see this settlement as anything but the latest blow struck. And you rest assured that I will continue in the struggle for human rights. Straight ahead, Russell Maroon Schultz." Under the terms of the settlement, the DOC has agreed to not place Maroon in solitary over his prior disciplinary record. He is to be single-celled for life, and Maroon was granted a monetary settlement. Maroon was held in solitary confinement from 1983 to 2014, with the exception of 19 months he spent in federal custody at Leavenworth, where he lived in general population. So for 22 consecutive years, a lifetime, Russell Maroon Schultz has been held by the state of Pennsylvania in isolation, conditions described as torture by the United Nations Special Rapporteur Juan Mendez, who called for Maroon's release from solitary. Mendez served as a defense expert for Schultz. Russell Maroon Schultz was represented in this federal civil rights action by Brett Grote and Dustin McDaniel, Esquires of the Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh, Harold J. Engel, Esquire, and attorneys Rick Etter and Stephanie L. Burt of the law firm Reed Smith. The struggle continues, and sometimes you win.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, reporting for Prison Radio. The long arm of civil law reaches at least as deep and far as criminal law. And if you don't have money, you will not find justice in civil law either. Evictions, home foreclosures, domestic disputes, all of these arenas of conflict come under civil law. David Udell is Executive Director of the National Center for Access to Justice, located at Cardozo Law School in New York City. His center has created a justice index that measures access to civil court justice in all 50 states. Udell says the civil law caseload dwarfs the criminal justice system.
There are about, in the federal court system, fewer than 500,000 cases a year, 300,000 or 400,000. But in the civil justice system in the states, there are about 20 million new cases on the civil side each year. And those state courts also handle another 20 million criminal cases each year. And then on top of that, they have about 50 million traffic cases. So when you add those numbers up, it's about 100 million cases. And those are very, very large numbers, and people generally don't have legal representation in those cases. So the question is, how fair can that be, particularly when one side does have a lawyer and the other side doesn't?
Well, that's where the real stuff of civil rights is, in civil law. Most folks have only sporadic contact with the criminal justice system, but the civil law surrounds us.
That's absolutely right. It is the civil justice system, and these are civil legal rights that we're speaking of. And in a way, the work that is done to represent poor people and communities of color and individuals of color in the civil courts is the cutting-edge civil rights set of issues of our day. Some of the issues that come up are explicitly about race and other forms of discrimination. There are employment cases where people are fired from their jobs, and there are cases where people aren't allowed to rent or aren't allowed to obtain the same kinds of financial arrangements that others are allowed to obtain. And so some of the civil cases explicitly deal with race. But as you point out, people who don't have a lot of money are caught up in the civil justice system on a daily basis. It's almost the oxygen around us that people are so often in court on debt collection matters, on family matters, on housing matters. And so what happens in the civil justice system is immensely important.
Your center has done a survey of all of the 50 states and D.C. and Puerto Rico, and you found lots of things wrong with the civil justice system, including, and this is a very interesting stat, that there's only one civil legal aid attorney for every 10,000 poor people across the country.
That's true, and we know that your listeners, many of them use the internet all the time, and we encourage people to look at the website called the Justice Index at justiceindex.org, where this information is gathered. And you're right, we were startled to see that there are so few civil legal aid lawyers available to represent the poor in civil matters. So when you look across the country, you see that the general number for number of lawyers per 10,000 people in the general population is something like 40 lawyers per every 10,000 people. But when you look at the number of legal aid lawyers per 10,000 people in poverty, the average is 0.64, less than one. And when you look at the number of states that actually have more than one lawyer per 10,000 poor people, you can count them on just about one hand. It's Washington, Hawaii, Connecticut, Maryland, New York, Alaska. Those are the ones that are above, and also D.C. All the other states have fewer than one legal services lawyer per 10,000 poor people. So we were really startled by those numbers, and I think many people have been startled by them. The issue isn't only about pay. It's more about funding enough of those jobs. And so we look to state government, we look to the federal government, which funds the Legal Services Corporation, to make sure that there aren't too many poor people per every lawyer available to address their very essential needs. And so when you're talking about the roof over someone's head or the benefits that are going to put food on the table or family disputes where there's violence or where a child is going to be taken away by the state, you really want to see in those matters of fundamental fairness that there's legal representation available. Certainly anybody with money who is purchasing a home or negotiating their rent would be consulting with a lawyer. And so it's startling to think that such enormous decisions are being made by people without any ability to talk to a lawyer.
In Louisiana, the criminal justice system has ground almost to a halt because of lack of funding of legal aid lawyers. One can only imagine what's occurring on the civil law side in places like Louisiana.
Well, that's a really good point because, You know, it's hard. It's sort of apples and oranges when you think about the criminal and the justice system and the civil justice system together. But certainly, if you consider that in the civil justice system, as a parent, you might lose the right under the law to be the parent to your own child or to see your own child, to take care of your own child. And all that can happen through the civil justice system. Whereas in the criminal justice system, you might be incarcerated briefly and still be entitled to have a lawyer to represent you. And of course, on the criminal side, there are problems funding the criminal justice system and the right to counsel. But there is a right to counsel, and that's created a platform for advocacy. And yet on the civil side, while some states authorize counsel in some kinds of matters, there is no state, and this is in our Justice Index also, there is no state that currently guarantees counsel where you're going to lose your home, for example, in foreclosure or in a rent matter. And not all the states provide counsel in cases in which you would lose your child in a neglect proceeding with the government or in custody proceedings with another parent. And so we like to point out, and our research demonstrates this, that even though a lawyer may be just as important, even more important to many people in certain kinds of civil cases, that it's generally not assured that you'll have that contact with a lawyer, with anyone, to help you with what could be a complicated matter that could really alter your life and the lives of those you love.
Lots of states, especially in the South, hit people with fees and all kinds of fines and civil problems, but your center has found that only 12 states require the courts to tell people, to tell the people who come before them, that these fees can be waived, that if you don't have the money, you don't have to pay.
Yes, so that's an interesting finding in the Justice Index. We look at the fees that are charged when people start new actions or answer new actions in civil court. So first, I would just note that, you know, we don't have in the Justice Index yet a comprehensive listing of all the different kinds of fees that are in place, and we think about expanding to include those kinds of listings. But just on the fees that are charged when you file or defend an action, it's very interesting. Every state entitles litigants to the opportunity to seek a waiver of fees in those instances. But very few states, as you point out, require that people be told about the opportunity to get that waiver. And so that is a startling finding that I think invites policy reform in the states to make sure that you have a fair chance to find out what you're eligible about, that the, you know, nobody's hiding the ball.
So although the state on paper provides or acknowledges a right, if there's no one informing the public of the right, that right doesn't really exist.
That's exactly right. We found, and here I can read off the data to you, it's 52 states waive the civil filing fee or fee to defend an action, but only 26 of the states simplify the waiver so that there's a presumption that if you're known to be poor in other ways, you would automatically get the waiver. And then only 12 states require court staff to explain the waiver. And only 34 states actually describe the waiver opportunity on their websites for the courts. So it's exactly as you've said. A right on paper isn't necessarily a right that anyone's going to tell you about, and therefore it's not necessarily even a right for all intents and purposes.
I've never seen a presidential campaign where a major contender runs on a platform that includes issues such as this, such as access to civil justice.
It's unfortunate. We're hoping that the Justice Index will help to raise the profile of these issues. The criminal justice system has received a great deal of attention in recent years, but the civil justice system still has not, but is starting to. I think a lot of people are starting to see that there are very intense connections between the two. So, for example, people who are unable to afford to pay their child support payments can end up in prison, but pass through the civil justice system and end up in prison. Of course, I'm not supporting the idea that anybody should not pay child support. I think it's important. But we also want to have arrangements through the law in which people can afford the support that they're being asked to pay and where they don't end up incarcerated and generating costs, being unable to work and also generating costs for society that would be avoided if payments were affordable. So there are lots of examples like that. People also end up with civil fees, as you had mentioned earlier, which can end up resulting in bench warrants. And we've all seen the report from the government about Ferguson and the headlines about Ferguson and the number of people who are just walking around with bench warrants out for their arrest, really for nothing other than the fact that they're poor to begin with and couldn't afford to pay fees. So it's very troubling to see the awful problems in our criminal justice system, but we hope that people will start to learn more about the civil justice system and the ways in which what happens in our state justice systems can end up with implications for the criminal justice system as a result of experiences in the civil justice system.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.